I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Call me Snake.
With blackest eyes, the devil's eyes. Purely and simply evil.
You're out of your
mind, Wayne.
God bless you.
What do we do?
Hello out there, and welcome back to Precinct 13, a podcast about the movies, music, and mind of John Carpenter. My name is Nick Rocco Scalia, one of your two co-hosts, joined as always by your other co-host, Chris Oliphant. Chris, you can't see me, though, because I am invisible.
I don't even know how to reply to that. Greetings, everyone.
As that ham-handed introduction should have tipped you off to, we are finally talking about John Carpenter's 1992 film Memoirs of an Invisible Man, which we've been alluding to on the show kind of since the first episode, I feel like.
Yeah, it's an odd one in the canon, and it's probably the one movie of Mr. Carpenter's that I was least passionate about and least familiar with. So there's that.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an outlier, like you said, and it's generally known as a sort of unsuccessful film in a lot of ways, but I don't know. I think we're going to have a lot to say about it, and I'm looking forward to talking about it. I feel like we've been just building up to this episode for the longest time, so I don't know why, because the movie is not really something that sets people's hearts aflame exactly, but we'll see where we can go with it. Before we get to that, though, I just wanted to mention a news story that I saw from a couple weeks ago. It was after we recorded our last episode, so we didn't get to talk about it last time around, but the Fantasia Fest is coming up in a couple of weeks, and although that festival, which is usually held in Montreal, is going to be virtual this year, like just about everything has gone virtual this year, not only do they seem to have a really great lineup of films, there's a new Neil Marshall movie. Neil Marshall, of course, the director of the great movie The Descent.
Ooh.
There's a documentary about fans of the Evil Dead franchise, a couple of foreign films that I'm just reading about now that sound really fascinating also. But the reason why I wanted to bring it up is that this is going to be a very John Carpenter-centric Fantasia Fest this year. He's going to be receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award, and he's doing a masterclass, which I would really love to get access to, but it sounds like that's not going to be something that the general public can just sort of sign into and pay for. But either way, should be a really awesome event, and for those who can actually make it to it, I would love to know what he has to say. It's good that he's still kind of getting out on the festival circuit, even though the festival circuit's not really what it used to be at this point.
Yeah, that would be great if he did one of those masterclass sessions. I get those all the time, like on my social media feeds, and you get everybody, you know, you get Scorsese and Tom Morello and all these crazy talented artists that, I mean, you can learn a lot just from listening to them talk for a couple minutes, but hey, congratulations, Mr. Carpenter. You certainly deserve it.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone, I think, should be getting a Lifetime Achievement Award at this point. This is a guy who has multiple podcasts, multiple websites, just sort of devoted to his directorial career. Yeah, I'd say there's a lot of Lifetime Achievement there. The other thing that I've been seeing so much of lately, and maybe this is because a lot of my online participation and the things I've been reading, I guess the algorithm just sort of knows I'm a Carpenter fan at this point, but I've been hearing nothing but exciting news about how Halloween Kills.
Yes. Yeah, there's been quite a bit of press on that lately. I was a really big fan of 2018's Halloween, directed by David Gordon Green, and it's a movie that gets better with multiple viewings. The last time I saw it, I was like fully in love with it. So I am really looking forward to Halloween Kills. I heard that they're kind of ratcheting up the brutality a little bit in this one.
Yeah, I read that. It seems like there's going to be a lot more throwbacks and tributes to earlier things from the franchise. I think Nick Castle is going to make an appearance in it, which is very cool. The original Michael Myers actor and, of course, longtime Carpenter confidant and friend and collaborator. So Yeah, I think it's getting pushed back to 2021 to like maybe fall 2021 at this point, the theatrical release.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the last one killed it at the box office. And I think the greatest decision they made was just to ignore the entirety of the franchise except for the original. That was a good approach to take.
Yeah, well, it seemed to work with the fans, and I guess I wasn't as big a fan of it as some people were, but it's definitely a movie I want to go back and revisit. I'll certainly do that before these two sequels, because they're producing Halloween Kills, and what's the last one called? There's one more that they're producing.
I think it's just called, I think it's Halloween Ends.
Halloween Ends, which it totally won't if that movie makes money, but...
Halloween Ends 2 is coming out after that.
Halloween Ends Again, or Halloween Begins Again, will be the fourth movie in that new franchise, just like they did with Friday the 13th. Seems to be kind of a slasher movie convention, but...
I still know that Halloween Ends last summer.
Oh, God. If you could get Jennifer Love Hewitt, I'd watch it. Anyway, sure. Just thought I'd bring up a little bit of Carpenter news that's happening now. I mean, it just seems like this flood of information about Halloween Kills is coming out, and that movie is going to be so overhyped by next Halloween season that I don't know how it could possibly live up to it. So I hope it's as good as everybody says it is. Jason Blum, of course, the guy behind Blumhouse, basically the biggest horror movie production company maybe ever. He's been talking this thing up since the beginning. He did produce the first movie, the David Gordon Green film we were just talking about as well. And he's just been sort of raving about what he's been seeing as the producer, which of course is a thing you do if you're the producer of a movie that's intended to be successful like that. But that guy knows his horror, and it sounds like he is really just pumped up to get this thing released and is really banking on this being a franchise that's going to last for a long time to come.
Well, one thing I give Jason Blum a lot of credit for it in particularly with the because I've been kind of following that production company since, you know, the Insidious franchise, and I really give him a lot of credit for just getting Carpenter back into involvement with the Halloween movies. You know, I believe it was him who pretty much was just like, listen, old man, you know, stop being such a grump, you know, and throwing rocks from the sidelines at these movies. Where we are, our approach to this is to make like a genuine quality Halloween film, and we want you to be, you know, involved with the score. We want you to be part of the production. And obviously I think that's a good draw for a lot of his fans, because I don't know, Nick, I've seen all the Halloween movies, and I've said this before, that it's my favorite horror franchise of all time, even though I know there's three or four of them in there that are just ridiculously bad movies. I, again, am throwing a lot of appreciation and respect for the 2018 version.
I feel like Halloween started as a franchise with a little bit more integrity than some of these other ones. I mean, Halloween, the original film, was never meant as a cash-in. I mean, it was kind of just a scrappy little independent film that ended up being a phenomenon. And so to bring some of that integrity back and to bring back the original story ideas and sort of just jettison some of the stuff along the way that was just kind of, you know, there to capture trends or something like that, or just to keep the franchise relevant in a climate that maybe was going in different directions. It's nice to see them just sort of go back to basics. And yeah, I mean, as long as Carpenter is involved, I'm definitely happy to see where that goes also. But I guess we've got a really long time to wait to see how that next film in the series is going to go. But what we have seen recently is Memoirs of an Invisible Man, and I am just itching to talk about it. I don't know about you.
I am. I really am. And I believe I'm ready at this point.
You have steeled yourself. You've prepared for the knockdown, drag-out discussion of Memoirs of an Invisible Man. All right, we'll be right back to get into it.
Next thing I knew, I went from high profile to no profile.
What have they done to me?
Wait a minute. Who are you guys?
Keep your mouths shut, all of you.
You're in a state of molecular flux. If you want to live, you're gonna have to trust us.
Where have you been? Everybody's looking for you.
I'm here. Sort of.
I want my molecules back!
All right, we are back, ready to talk about not so much John Carpenter's Memoirs of an Invisible Man, but maybe Chevy Chase's Memoirs of an Invisible Man?
Yeah, this was certainly a... this project, based upon the research that I've done, was quite an obsession of his. I guess he read the book Chevy Chase we're talking about here, and was really passionate about adapting it into a film. And essentially, we'll get into the details of this as we go along, but somehow this ended up in John Carpenter's lap after a series of failed attempts to make some other movies during his lawsuit with Alive Films. Which, by the way, Nick, did you see that John Carpenter was considered as a director for Exorcist 3?
I did, and I was going to bring that up because I know that's one of your favorite horror movies, and we've talked about that on a previous podcast. We've talked about it just sort of in person a number of times, and man, I just, not to get too far off track here, but I can't even imagine what a John Carpenter-directed Exorcist 3 would be like. I have to imagine it would be better. I'm not a big fan of that film. I know I'm kind of in the minority about that, but I would have loved to have seen what he could have done with it, because I always felt that movie was kind of talky and kind of said more than it showed, and I feel like a John Carpenter version would do the opposite of that. It would have been kind of a real extravaganza of supernatural religious horror, and I'm sorry that we never got that version of it.
Yep. I just wanted to, I didn't want to get off track, but I did want to point that out because that's a little factoid that I never knew. And I was like, oh my God, that's crazy. Go ahead.
I'm just going to say, this is a really, as we've talked about on the show a few times, this is a dormant period in Carpenter's career. As you mentioned, he was involved in legal troubles with Alive Films, and he was supposed to have a third film to follow up Prince of Darkness and They Live, and that never materialized. There was a number of scripts that he was being considered for, and basically he got back in the game. I mean, the quote that I read said something like, well, I hadn't made a movie in a while, so I figured I would do this one. Just to go back a little bit, as you were saying, this was a novel by someone named H.F. Saint, and it was actually optioned to be a movie before the novel even got published. So before anybody had really read this, except for producers and people who had early access to it, this was already going to be a movie, which is a thing that, I guess, just sort of doing research over the years for other projects, that's a pretty common thing where producers will just snap up the rights to something because it seems like it is going to be a successful literary thing and has cinematic potential. I mean, I think some writers sometimes write specifically to be optioned by producers. They write things that are a little bit more cinematic. We've seen that even a couple times with Stephen King, things that he hasn't even put out into the world yet that are already fast-tracked for development as movies. So this was initially, it was Chevy Chase's baby kind of from the start. So, you know, if we're going to criticize this as a Carpenter film, or, you know, I don't want to come down too hard on Chevy Chase today, because I think he did a number of things right on this project, but this was essentially an attempt by Chevy Chase to get out of the stereotypical roles that he had been sort of typecast in. But I don't know. I mean, he wanted to do a more serious type of movie. He wanted to sort of take this Invisible Man story, just in the stuff that I've read, he wanted to make a more kind of introspective movie about what it would be like to be invisible and to not be able to interact in the world the way someone normally might. Where I sort of am a little confused by all this is, you know, like, it seems like he wants to get away from comedy a lot, because the comedy that he had done, like I keep seeing mentions of Clark Griswold and the Vacation movies, and
yes,
he
yes.
wanted to do something different from those. I love those movies, by the way. I'm a big Chevy Chase fan, I think, in general. But
yep.
to me, I mean, the Chevy Chase persona is more that Saturday Night Live, Caddyshack, Fletch kind of persona, where it's not so much this bumbling suburban dad who's just trying to make good times for his family. You know, like, I like Clark Griswold a lot too. I mean, yes, he's kind of a bumbler, but his heart's in the right place. But like the other Chevy Chase characters are, you know, they're sarcastic, they're witty, they're really suave. I think of Ty Webb and Caddyshack. That might be my favorite comedy.
Sure. Yeah.
And of course, Fletch, this reporter who can kind of disguise himself as anyone. So I don't necessarily know that people, and of course, his Saturday Night Live persona also, you know, he was the Weekend Update guy. He was kind of the smarter than everybody else in the room. What did he say? I'm Chevy Chase and you're not. That was his like catchphrase at the end of that.
That's what I tell people when I meet them. I say, listen, I'm Chris Oliphant and you're not. There you go.
Have I been pronouncing your name wrong all these years, by the way?
No, nobody knows how to pronounce it. It's there's no like official way to do it. Oliphant, Oliphant. It's just however you feel.
I get Scalia a lot too, so whatever. Either way.
Well, let me comment on what you were saying there really quickly, because I think the reason why there was so much mention of, you know, Clark Griswold is because, I mean, this was only 3 years after Christmas Vacation, and it doesn't look like, I mean, that seem, looking at his filmography here, that was the last big project that he was in. I mean, Nothing But Trouble, directed by Dan Aykroyd. I'm sure I have never seen that movie, but doesn't look like it was a huge hit.
Oh, man, Chris, you should see Nothing But Trouble.
Oh, really? I would totally check it out.
That's basically like, it's almost like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie as a comedy. It's like, I guess if I had to compare it to something, maybe House of a Thousand Corpses?
I am literally taking a note right now to watch it, but...
I didn't say it was good. I just said you should see it.
I'd just be fascinated by it. But, I mean, listen, everyone loves Christmas Vacation. I may have seen that movie more than any other movie ever made. And
I'm up there, too.
Yeah, and there's something very magical about that movie. It's like the epitome of a film that just never gets old. It's never not funny. But what you're saying is absolutely right. Like, this is like kind of his attempt to at least start building a bridge into making movies where he had more serious roles. And yeah, I see what you're saying is that like there's other modalities of his acting that could have been applied to this. Like, why they kept thinking of it, oh, you know, it's going to be Clark Griswold, you know, becomes invisible sort of thing, was their concern, I guess. But he's still, like, funny in this movie.
Yeah, well, the initial drafts of this movie were written by William Goldman, like, one of the greatest screenwriters of all time. He did The Princess Bride, like, right around the same time he was working on this script. That was 87, and this was, like, I believe the novel came out in 87 and was intended to be made a movie sooner than it was. So, like, probably before Christmas Vacation, but you still had National Lampoon's Vacation. I think that was 83, right. and European Vacation. That was a very successful franchise even then. But I guess Goldman's idea was to really sort of play up the comedic aspects. Something I read somewhere said, I think this was Chevy Chase's complaint, where he's like 5 minutes into that script and the Invisible Man is like looking up a woman's skirt undetected. And, you know, I guess nobody really wanted that movie. Like, I guess what I'm saying is I kind of understand Chevy Chase's frustration at not wanting to turn this into just a big budget special effects comedy. The original director of this was Ivan Reitman. And of course, he is, you know, pretty well-known comedy director, but his biggest movie probably of all time is Ghostbusters, which, you know, the tone of this, I could easily see it going in a more Ghostbusters direction. But, like, how many movies have tried to rip off Ghostbusters and just could not get the sort of timing and the comedy and the sensibility of it right? You know, I mean, it's very hard to do a special effects comedy, right? And there's so few of those that are actually good, and when they fail, they're just so cringeworthy and pain. I'm thinking of like the Men in Black sequels. Like, the original Men in Black is very clever and similar to Ghostbusters in a lot of ways, but every time someone just, you know, throw a bunch of money at this comedy project, it just kind of never seems to work, to me at least. So I could see him sort of approaching it from that respect. Goldman eventually left the project. I believe his quote was something like, "I make too much money to do this shit."
Yes, yes, yep. Yeah, I'm too old and too rich for this
shit. Too old and too rich, yeah. So, you know, I'm a huge William Goldman fan. I've read all his books. I love his screenplays. I mean, I think Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid is one of the greatest screenplays ever written. He did all The President's Men. I mean, he is top tier of Hollywood screenwriters. But, I mean, I could see how that vision for the project might clash with someone's like Chevy Chase's. I mean, Chevy Chase, I guess, here was trying to be Bill Murray before Bill Murray became this respected actor, you know, in like Wes Anderson movies and Lost in Translation and that kind of stuff. So
yes.
This project was kind of in limbo. It kept being rewritten and passed around from director to director. Richard Donner, who directed the original Superman movie and who did Lethal Weapon, he was attached to it for a long time. And he ended up leaving the project. And I didn't see a lot about sort of what his problems were or what the problems were with him. But I mean, it sounds like Chevy Chase had a very clear vision for this that maybe writers just weren't seeing the same way he was, and maybe was impossible to realize in general, right? Like, this was never going to be a super serious movie. This was never going to be the sort of horror tinged Invisible Man story that the original classic Invisible Man was like, or even, I mean, we just saw an Invisible Man movie. That was the last movie I saw in a theater before things shut down this year. Yeah, and yes. I mean, that was certainly a much, much darker, there was nothing comedic about that one. That was a really sort of serious suspense thriller horror take on this same idea. So didn't want to do that, didn't want to do it as a comedy. Somehow this ends up in the hands of John Carpenter, who was just kind of looking for a project. Chevy Chase as the producer of this, it was a Cornelius production, which is his production company that I think only formed for this movie. So these two sort of strange bedfellows got together, and basically Carpenter's task with the writers of this was to come up with something that used the Chevy Chase persona for both comedic and dramatic effect. And, you know, the results were not terribly successful. This was debuted at number 2 at the box office and kind of died a slow and painful death from there. It's generally considered one of Carpenter's worst movies. But I think before we really get into it, we should put our cards on the table. Chris, what did you think of Memoirs of an Invisible Man?
I was listening to our previous episode. It was funny. I was talking about how the only recollection I had of watching this movie a few years ago was that I was just like, it was okay. And for whatever reason, I wasn't really paying attention that much. I just didn't really care about what was going on. I will say that after watching it this time, I do appreciate it a little bit more. I think that there is some look, like I said before, I think Chevy Chase is, although he is trying to portray a more serious role and kind of exploring the elements of like loneliness and isolation, being invisible and things of that nature. But I think Chevy Chase is pretty funny in this movie. Like, I laughed out loud at a couple of his lines, there's a little bit of slapsticky stuff in here. The special effects are the best part of this movie. There's a lot of really cool, I think what could even be considered at the time some pretty groundbreaking effects. Sam Neill is just awesome. I just love Sam Neill, like, in general. And so I was able to enjoy him in this movie. Daryl Hannah is not good in this movie. I just wanted to say this really quickly because I recently watched Oliver Stone's Wall Street, which she's also in and also not good in. And it's weird because, like, I think of her obviously for her role in, like, the Kill Bill movies where she's, like, so fantastic, but I watched two movies with Daryl Hannah from the same era in a very short window of time, and in both of them, she's just so bland and just so, like, I don't know. She just seems like she doesn't even want to be in either of those movies, I should say. My criticism of the movie is going to be, though, that, like, although it does have those qualities to it, and I can appreciate it a little bit more. Oh, I should also mention the music is pretty darn good in this, too, done by Shirley Walker, who would later work with John Carpenter on Escape from New York, or L.A., sorry. There's just no stakes in it, you know? Like, when I'm watching the movie, I'm thinking to myself, I don't remember how this ends. How does it end? I just found myself not really caring how it was going to end. You know, if he stays invisible or not, it didn't really matter. It didn't really matter to me. And so there was just no, like, emotional attachment to the character because, to be honest, like, his character is, like, sort of a dick in this movie, you know? Like, he's not someone that I find a sympathetic figure. So overall, I mean, I appreciate it more than I did before, but I think I could easily say that this is my least favorite of the John Carpenter movies up to this point. I'd rather watch any other one he's made than this one.
Fair enough. We could probably just end the episode there. I think you covered it pretty much front to back, and I agree with a lot of what you just had to say. What I will say is I think I enjoyed it a little bit more than you did. I was expecting, maybe because my expectations were so low for this, just because of the critical reputation that it has, I was expecting this to just be a total slog.
And hold on, though, Nick. It's not as good as Black Moon Rising, though.
No, I enjoyed the shit out of Black Mirror. I want to watch that movie again right now. If you haven't listened to our last episode, we talked about some of John Carpenter's screenwriting credits, films that he didn't direct, and I think we both had a much, much better time with that kind of critically maligned movie than anyone might have been expecting.
Yeah.
No, I don't think this is as good as Black Moon Rising, but what I will say about this film is, first of all, this reminds me very much of an era of Hollywood movie making that I think has long since passed, but this was the era of the sort of big budget special effects blockbusters that are kind of not really attached to a franchise. It's not really a, you know, it's not launching a cinematic universe. It has a similar feel to me to like the 1989 Batman movie and, you know, like this was an era where you could get away with something like this. They're kind of movies for adults that are based on kind of very comic booky, high concept sort of premises. And,
sure,
you know, now movies like this, now when we see films in this genre, they're generally, they're familiar franchises. They're Marvel movies or something like that, or they're the latest entry in the Fast and the Furious series. I mean, this is kind of its own thing and really just reminded me of a time. And I don't think it's the best of those movies from that era, but that's definitely like an era of movies that is meaningful to me. That's where I sort of developed my love for the movies. And particularly around this period, you know, you just had Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade and Terminator 2 and just a lot of, you know, blockbuster movies that really kind of stuck with me. And this kind of, you know, maybe it's just the time period and the clothing and the cars and everything like that. But to me, it's a mode of filmmaking that we don't really see as much anymore. And I don't know. I mean, I saw there's a lot of problems in this movie that I think could have been dealt with on a script level. And then, like you were saying, there are a lot of elements that I think really work well. Like the special effects in this are fantastic. I mean, this is early CGI composited with a lot of practical effects. This is Industrial Light and Magic. So the company who basically has been responsible for most of the greatest special effects in Hollywood history. Like, you don't bring in that heavy hitter kind of a company unless you're really planning on making a real extravaganza of special effects. And this is that. I mean, there's moments still that just really, really hold up. And to watch a movie from this era in high definition, which is what I did, a lot of times the seams will really start to show. You could kind of get away with more back then than you can now, where everything is in super high def, 4K, just really clean, clear digital picture. But this, I thought, still looked really, really, like there's a moment where he's running around and he's just sort of a disembodied pair of pants. And I was just like, wow, that's kind of amazing looking. And eventually he actually takes the pants off and they're just sort of like flopping around in the air while he's running. It's pretty amazing. So I really, really did like the visual effects. And I thought it kind of had some interesting story elements too, but I know this is called Memoirs of an Invisible Man, right? But there is so much voiceover in this movie. And basically the Chevy Chase character, Nick Holloway is his name. He's basically an investment banker who completely by accident has no interest in science or invisibility at all. He's just at a presentation at, what's the name of the company? Magnetronics or something like that?
I don't know. But I think it's really funny how he's just completely hungover at this thing. And like, I like that a lot. Like he just goes walking around, this building. I don't remember the name of the company, Nick, but, yeah, he just takes a nap.
Well, he's looking for a bathroom and then he stumbles into a sauna. Before that, he sort of startles a guy who spills some coffee onto his computer, which starts a chain reaction that sets off whatever device they're working on and turns like portions of the building invisible. I mean, it's like, I don't know. I guess I wanted a little more engagement from my protagonist. I think that's kind of the point. He's this disaffected kind of slickster corporate guy. Up until that point, we've just known him as just this sort of lazy rich dude who kind of coasts through life and lives a very luxurious kind of corporate existence without really doing much of note.
Yeah, his secretary says to him, "You're the biggest bullshit artist I've ever met in my life."
Yeah. Which we kind of get a little bit of as the movie goes on. And of course, Chevy Chase is Fletch, so maybe one of cinema's great bullshit artists. But I don't know. What I was saying was, it's called Memoirs of an Invisible Man, so obviously based on that title, you know he's going to be reflecting back on his experiences of being invisible. But like every 30 seconds or so in this movie, we get voiceover from Chevy Chase that's basically just explaining stuff that either we should know or is kind of just happening right in front of us, and that really pulls me out of the story. I mean, it's not a really reflective voiceover, it's just kind of an explanatory, kind of expositional voiceover, and I have to imagine that if William Goldman had been able to write this script the way he wanted, we at least wouldn't have gotten that, because that it definitely just feels a little cheap and a little lazy.
I completely agree, although I don't really mind Chevy Chase's voice itself. I think as a narrator...
Oh, no, I like his voice, sure.
Yeah, I think his voice is fine, but you're right. It is all... this movie is so, like, just saturated with that kind of narration. Before I forget, I wanted to say one thing that also kind of gave this movie a little bit more, I don't know what's the word I'm thinking of, just what gave it more respectability, I guess, for me, because I'm obviously not talented enough to make movies, but I think part of why I didn't like this movie as much the first time I saw it was because I hadn't seen all of John Carpenter's other movies yet at that point, so I didn't. At that point, I was watching it and going, this seems... I couldn't find the elements of this movie that were Carpenter, you know? And this time watching it, I totally could. Well, one thing I thought of right away, Nick, we get some serious helicopter action going on in this movie.
Yeah.
The helicopters are back. You know, there's the whole, like CIA, you know, shadow government institution aspect to it. And... I don't know. I saw some of his fingerprints on this movie, and I was surprised to have discovered.
Yeah, there's definitely elements. I mean, just the opening scene of this movie, it's kind of a flash forward where Nick Holloway, as the invisible man that he's become, kind of sits down to record a testimonial about what's happened to him in case the CIA actually catches up to him. And he's being chased by helicopters through a nighttime city. There's all this kind of like these devices that they're using to find him. And I don't know, that really had an Escape from New York vibe to me.
Sure. Yeah.
This sort of nighttime lit up kind of chase movie vibe that it was giving off. And I would have liked to have seen a little bit more of that. Reminds me a little bit of Starman also. Like that is in some ways similar in that it's a man on the lam movie and he's kind of just involved in this burgeoning romance while also being chased down by the bad guys and has to sort of always be eluding his pursuers. And the Daryl Hannah character is along with him for the ride, and they're getting to know each other. You know, that's a very Hitchcockian thing, that's sort of very North by Northwest. So, yeah, I mean, you can see some Carpenter elements there. John Carpenter is a great action director, and there's not as much action in this movie as I would have liked, but there's moments where, like, for example, Nick, when he's invisible, he goes back to his apartment, and these guys catch up to him. They don't know he's there, obviously, because he's invisible. And there's this really great suspenseful moment where they're like out in the hallway outside of his apartment and he has to kind of sneak past them. And he obviously has to be extremely quiet. They can't see him, but if he touches them or he makes too much noise, he's going to get caught out. And I think moments like that are handled really, really well. And they remind me of, you know, the stalk and chase kind of stuff that I think Carpenter is very, very good at. I will say, though, like, the style of comedy in this movie is kind of a little outside of Carpenter's wheelhouse. Like, his comedy is more the kind of big, brash, silent film, you know, Big Trouble in Little China kind of comedy. And you don't really get as much of that here. Like, the comedy is intended to be more of that sort of low-key, witty, Saturday Night Live Chevy Chase kind of comedy. And, you know, just droll and a little bit dry and... I don't necessarily think that plays as well as it should. Like, I don't consider him a great director of that kind of comedy. So, like, I'm thinking about there's a moment where Nick basically stows away at his friend's beach house. His friend George, played by the great Michael McKean, who one of my favorite performers from the movie Clue and many, many other things.
He's great in this movie.
Yeah, he is. He's fun, George. So Nick basically hides out in his house. He calls this delivery boy to come over and bring him booze. And the delivery boy is kind of poking through George's stuff. Like, George is obviously a very wealthy character. And this guy is fixing on maybe stealing something. He's like going through the drawers and things. And Nick, invisible Nick, kind of sneaks up behind him. And he's like, hey, dickwad. And then the scene just kind of ends. And
yeah,
you know, I feel like there's a lot of abortive moments of comedy like that, where you've got this great setup for something really funny to happen. And, you know, the best they can get is the line, hey, dickwad, which made me laugh. Don't get me wrong. But
yeah. How about that beach house? Jeez.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah. Yeah. Great settings in this movie also. I mean, another thing I kind of liked was we see a little bit of kind of the San Francisco, like, glitterati. Like, Nick comes from this very wealthy sort of corporate world. And as we were talking about with Eyes of Laura Mars, right? Like, that's not something you generally see in Carpenter films. His characters are a little bit more down to earth and don't really exist in these kind of rarefied, wealthy kind of spaces. So, like, we basically meet Nick as he's in his corporate office, and he goes to this really fancy club that a bunch of scenes in the movie are set in, and it's these wealthy, educated, kind of upper-class people that we're seeing in this movie. And then, of course, he ends up basically on the streets. He kind of goes from riches to rags, as it were, because, I mean, I guess the one thing this movie gets across really well is kind of how hard it would be to be invisible. Like, you really can't do anything without getting caught.
Yeah, so let's backtrack just a little bit here, because we're kind of going all over the place, which is fine. I don't think we really had a like an outline of how we were going to go over this movie. But just for our listeners who may have not seen this movie, Nick, can you give this movie the 2-minute plot, basically?
Yeah, absolutely. So Nick Holloway is a successful but kind of disaffected, I think he's like an investment banker. Like, we never really get a job title for him, but he works in finance. He's played by Chevy Chase, so he's got this kind of slick, kind of very, I don't know, I think disaffected, the word I've already used. I think that's a good word for him.
He is a stock analyst.
He's a stock analyst, okay. And I don't know enough about finance. I assume that's different from an investment banker. That's why I'm not wealthy like Nick Holloway. I'm a film nerd, so I'm poor like Nick Scalia. But basically he's kind of just going through his life. He's kind of he's a bit of a slacker. Like, usually someone in that kind of job is kind of a real aggressive, like Wolf of Wall Street type character, but he's really not. He kind of just lets things happen around him and collects his paycheck and just kind of moves on with things. He meets Alice, the Daryl Hannah character, through his friend George at this club that he goes to. They hit it off kind of right away. I'm not exactly sure why. Like, she seems a little bit more sophisticated than him, and she seems like the kind of person who would see through his bullshit, but for some reason she doesn't. They have a hookup in the bathroom at the club, and they say they're going to meet again, and for some reason, and again, this is a thing that happens in voiceover, and I'm not sure why, so he has this, like, meet cute with this woman that he really likes. They hook up, they seem to really like each other, they set another date, so it seems like the beginning of a really good romance that's happening there. And then he just, for some reason, goes back into the bar at the club and just gets pissed drunk.
Yeah. I don't know how he got her into the ladies' room so easily. He's like, I love philanthropy. I love all the things that you do. Like, right off the bat, he's just mesmerized by this woman.
And fair enough. She looks really great in this movie. I would say it's not her best performance. I love her in Blade Runner. And of course, she's great in Splash. And she's amazing in the Kill Bill movies. This is maybe not Daryl Hannah at her most committed, as you were saying. But yeah, I mean, this romance kind of gets off to a very successful start. And then he just goes and, like, drinks himself into a stupor, which maybe he's celebrating how good he did. But I don't know. It seems like something you would do after a really bad date. But anyway, so he wakes up super hungover the next morning. He has to go to this presentation at some kind of technological scientific corporation, which, of course, him being super hungover and just being the disaffected guy that he is, he's really bored with. So,
All right. I'm going to put you on pause for one sec because I just thought of something. And you're doing a great job. I'm, like, picturing this whole movie going through my head as you're talking about it.
Oh, good.
So I think the reason why he goes back to the bar and gets drunk is because he was really hoping to hook up with her that night. And he thought that, like, when she says to George and his wife, like, oh, I have to go, you know, he thought that she was just putting on a play so that she could go run away with him for the night. But when she's like, no, I seriously do have another obligation, he's like, oh, okay. And then goes back to the bar and gets smashed.
But she has sex with him in the ladies' room before that, and they basically do make plans to meet again, don't they?
But do they go all the way?
Well, I don't know, Chris. It's a PG-13 movie, so I'm not sure.
I don't know. I don't know that they went all the way there. I think they just, like, were just making out.
Maybe. I thought they went all the way, and I thought the implication was that they were making plans to meet again, and like, that's another thing that gets dropped too. Like, she says she's got something important to do later on that evening, and so she breaks away from him, and I thought that was because she was going to be involved with something. Like, maybe she had something to do with some other faction in this movie, and we were going to learn that later. That was going to be a twist. But no, I guess she just she doesn't want to spend the night. She's not that kind of girl. But either way, I mean, it's I guess it's not really that important. I will say one thing, like one of the only things I remember about this movie, I did see it when it came out. I saw it when it probably showed up on VHS in 1992 or 1993. I was a little kid at the time, and I remember my parents, I think they watched it with me, and I think they were a little concerned about all the sex in this movie, which there's nothing explicit whatsoever, but I guess it was a little sexy, a little erotic for a little kid at the time. I mean, it pushed its PG-13 rating probably as far as you could push it at the time. But yeah, so as we were saying before, Nick goes to this presentation, he sneaks out, he's looking for a bathroom, he finds a sauna in this building because they've got a pretty nice corporate headquarters there, and just sort of lays down and decides to take a nap in the sauna. And when he wakes up, this malfunction that he inadvertently caused by startling this scientist who spills coffee on his computer. Like, how many movies have someone just spilling coffee on a computer that starts off a horrible chain reaction and somebody ends up getting, like, blown up or sent back through time or something like that? Like, it's a device that I could use to never see again, maybe.
I have never known a cup of coffee to do as much damage as it does in this movie.
No, like, I've spilled coffee on so many computers and I've never been turned invisible.
At first there's just like some sparks, and then there's lots of sparks, and then like and then like everything that is electronic in the building just starts blowing up. And it's interesting because like the way that the outcome of all of it is that like it looks like the building exploded, but it's like there's like fragments of the building that are still there.
Yeah, which is an amazing visual. That was the other thing I remembered from the first time seeing this movie. I mean, that is the sort of most memorable set in the movie, and the most memorable set piece is this corporate headquarters. It basically, like, parts of it just disintegrate. They go invisible. So there's like floating like roofs and walls and offices, and we get a lot of great exterior shots of it because, as you were saying, when this all happens, I thought you were going to mention like this sequence where the malfunction is happening. It's so much like a Looney Tunes short where they just keep cutting back and it just gets more and more chaotic every time. So yeah, first it's just a few sparks and then something's on fire. And then we cut back to Nick just kind of lying down in the sauna and then like all hell is breaking loose. Yeah. So, and then people are evacuating the building, right? So he's the only one left in the building. Something happens and we never really get a good sense of what exactly they're messing around with at this corporation, but he becomes invisible, realizes that pretty quickly. The authorities are dispatched, and almost immediately the CIA shows up on the scene because I guess this company was some kind of defense contractor. And that is where we meet our main antagonist. What is his name? It's Jenkins, I think. David Jenkins?
David Jenkins, yep, played by Sam Neill.
Yeah, so he's kind of this, I don't know what we want to call him. I mean, he's like a CIA fixer or something. I mean, he's one of those.
Wikipedia just says shady CIA operative.
He's a shady CIA operative. That's exactly what he is. Well, I feel like there's a name for that, though. Like these guys that just sort of go into foreign countries and stir shit up for the CIA. I mean, there have been people like that throughout history. And I think
there's that scene where he's like on trial and he's being grilled about, like, you know, all this nefarious shit that he's done, like, in other parts of the world, right?
Yeah, and I think he's just out for sort of fame and glory and to be the sort of dashing CIA spy guy. He's like looking to play a part in world events, whereas he works for Stephen Tobolowsky, another great, great actor who kind of appears just briefly in this movie, and he's a much more by-the-book kind of guy and just wants them to deal with this situation. But very quickly, Jenkins, who's a very slick kind of shady guy, as you were saying, he sees that there could be some money and some power inherent in having an invisible man, I guess, to recruit as a spy. You know, who would, like, what country who is maybe an enemy of the United States wouldn't pay a ton of money to have an invisible spy working for them? So he basically wants to capture Nick and make him, I guess, force him to be a spy or sell him to the highest bidder or dissect him or something like that. I mean, it's one of those, like The Shape of Water kind of thing, like these government figures who are just out to cause chaos and sort of profit for themselves. And so that's basically what the conflict of the film is Nick adjusting to the life of being invisible and starting to sort of discover that there might not be a cure for his invisibility, and Jenkins pursuing him from place to place because he wants to capture him. So it becomes kind of a chase movie and also, I guess, kind of a fish out of water movie where Nick is learning to adapt to being invisible, and like the rules of his invisibility are a little bit tough to follow, and then the way the film portrays his invisibility is a little tough to follow. So
yeah,
like in terms of his clothing and stuff like that, seems like sometimes that does go invisible with him, but sometimes it doesn't. Like at one point he's wearing a scarf and he wears bandages, just sort of like the Lon Chaney Invisible Man.
I have a theory behind that.
Okay.
I think that the suit that he was wearing when he initially became invisible went invisible along with him. But everything else that he wears, clothing-wise, like hat, you know, scarf, jacket, shows up because it wasn't there at the time of the event.
I believe that, but I feel like they break that rule once or twice. I'm not sure. Maybe I'm wrong.
They might, but I thought about it because he actually uses that as a mechanism later on in the movie, because that suit that he was wearing, like there's a scene where he's at George's house and Alice is in the room getting hit on by that
that guy with a very deep voice who almost sexually assaults her, and then Nick, in one of his only real heroic moments in the movie, steps in and prevents that from happening. I think that's a great scene,
right? And he was able to keep himself invisible because he changed back into the outfit that he was wearing at the time of the event.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely makes sense, right? Because parts of the building, like, it's not just people that are turned invisible in this. It's not like the recent Invisible Man movie where it's a suit that you put on that makes you invisible, but it's literally the molecules of everything that was affected by it. So I think that's true. I'm just not sure if they stick to that rule as well as they should. And then the other thing I was saying is, so we do see a lot of Chevy Chase in this movie. Like, the way it's shot, sometimes we can see Nick as, you know, he would appear to anyone who actually was visible. And sometimes it's just a little hard to tell, I guess. I mean, we almost forget sometimes, right? Like, sometimes it just looks like normal Chevy Chase in a normal scene and nobody is invisible. Am I crazy in saying that?
Not at all. I think it's a fair point.
I mean, I guess it's a tough thing to do as a filmmaker, and I'm not sort of coming down on Carpenter or Chevy Chase or anybody for maybe not handling this perfectly, but, you know, he is the star of your movie. You can't do these impressive ILM special effects in every scene, so sometimes we just have to see Chevy Chase as Chevy Chase, but I don't know. I mean, I think they could have balanced that a little bit better and been a little bit clearer about it at times. This is not a perfect movie by any means, but I mean, it does have a chase narrative that works pretty well. There's some great kind of running away and escaping scenes. What might be my favorite moment in the movie, it's early on where he's looking to hitch a ride. He's kind of out on the street. He's vulnerable. He's invisible. He doesn't know what to do. So he goes to hail a cab. And the way he does that is by knocking out a drunk guy. And
dude,
basically, like, using him as a puppet, like, kind of puppeteering this guy. And the cab driver, you know, like many movie cab drivers, he's seen it all. So he just kind of doesn't, like, doesn't really seem to notice that this guy's mouth is not really moving, and he doesn't seem to be controlling his own body, and then he pulls over to throw up on the side of the road. Like, I thought that was a really funny scene.
Yeah, it absolutely was. I love how he just knocks the dude out with the suitcase.
Yes.
Like,
he's got like a metal briefcase and he just donks him in the head with it.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
That's a great scene. What I didn't like is he's escaping from his apartment building. That scene I was talking about earlier. He goes into this one apartment and it's the little old lady from The Wedding Singer. You've seen that movie, I'm sure.
Yes, of course.
Mm-hmm. That cute little old lady. And he basically just like slams a door into her and knocks her to the ground and just runs past her. And I'm like, you can't have the protagonist of your movie knock out a little old lady like that.
Yeah, that was pretty brutal.
Even the drunk businessman guy that he knocks out to hail the cab, like that was pretty bad, but a little old lady, that's just unconscionable. There's another sort of similar scene like that where he's walking down the street and there's a purse snatcher. This lady's walking, guy runs by and steals her purse, and Invisible Nick just grabs the purse, gives it back to the lady. The purse snatcher's like, what the hell just happened? And the lady's like, what the hell just happened? And he just kind of keeps on walking. Like, I love moments like that, and I wish there'd been a little bit more of that.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think that might be my absolute favorite scene in the whole movie. and it's just like when that happened and the way he does it just so casually, I was like, oh, that's cool, you know. And yeah, for sure, if they could have peppered more stuff like that into the movie, I think it would have been a little bit more enjoyable.
Well, it's like these two sensibilities kind of pushing up against each other, right? Because I think if you went too far in that direction, then this would have been just a slapstick Chevy Chase comedy, and Chevy Chase didn't want that, and I'm sure Carpenter had never really intended to make that kind of movie. But if you took all that stuff out, then this would be kind of a bland sci-fi action thriller, and nobody wants bland anything. So, I don't know. It has a very tough time, I think, balancing those two goals, and also, you know, there is a romance at the heart of this that, I don't know, like the Alice character, call me crazy if you don't agree with this, but it seems like she goes along with everything just way too easily. Like, there's very little conflict there. He eventually reveals himself to her. I mean, he's kind of smitten with her from the beginning, and he misses a date with her because he's gone invisible. And, you know, about 2/3 of the way through the movie, they meet back up, and she is sort of filled in on the situation, and of course she's shocked and scared at first, but very quickly, I mean, it doesn't take long, even just in that one scene, for her to kind of go along with it and like, yes, I'll help you hide out, I'll go on the run with you and all that stuff. And, you know, I get that they're trying to do that very Hitchcockian sort of romance, like couple on the lam kind of thing, but I don't know, I mean, it just seems too easy, too obvious. I feel like there's a lot more story there that we just don't really get.
I completely agree. There's that stupid scene where she's like fixing him a plate of food in the kitchen, like after they already ate dinner, and she's like, I'm just really hungry, and like makes a plate with like, there's like a huge like filet on it, and just then grabs like a bottle of champagne, and she's like, I'm kind of tired, I'm just going to go eat this and go to bed. And they're like, huh, like what's going on? I mean, there's even a scene in this movie where George hears her having a conversation with him, with Nick through the door of her bedroom. He's hearing her talk to another person, and like, he's not freaked out that there's someone else in the house. Or I didn't really understand that.
I mean, a lot of the second half of this movie feels very rushed. Like, there's a scene where he's at the beach house, he's invisible, and this is before he and Alice kind of get back together, and George and his wife and this other deep-voiced sexual assault guy, and I don't know who that actor is. He's got a great voice, but he's a dirtbag in this movie. And yeah. And Alice, and they're all together, and they're basically like shit-talking Nick. They think behind his back. They don't realize he's there. And like, that's a great dramatic scene, right? Like, he's amongst what he thinks are his best friends, and you know, he's friends with George's wife also.
It's very much like A Christmas Carol.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're talking about just kind of what a kind of a loser he is, and what an I don't know. I don't know if loser is exactly, like, do you remember? I don't remember exactly what their criticism of him was.
He's a narcissist.
He's a narcissist. That's what it is. He's kind of full of himself and is not really getting, he's never going to have like the stable marriage and thing, like whatever they have. And, you know, he's really hurt by this, obviously. And I think that's a great dramatic scene. But then that thread is sort of dropped. And then George ends up helping him in the climax of the movie. And like, he really puts George at risk. Like, I'm surprised George didn't get shot. I mean, by that point in the film, we know that Jenkins, the Sam Neill character, he will stop at nothing. I mean, he is a killer and does not care about human life at all. I mean, so, like, why he would go back and sort of help his friend like that, I don't know. It feels like there are missing pieces to this movie, almost like that building. It's that corporate headquarters that gets sort of made partially invisible. It's almost like a metaphor for the whole movie.
Yeah, it's a symbolic image to the that correlates to the movie. I think read somewhere in some review that this movie had an identity crisis, and I think that is spot on, because it really, when you read about the kind of the inspiration for the film and what kind of, you know, not genre, but what kind of vibe they were going for, and then what the results ended up being, it really is kind of confusing. I'm like, what type of movie is this supposed to be? You know, is this supposed to be more of a drama, or is it supposed to be a comedy? Is it just a, you know, or see, again, I reference Wikipedia, says it's a black sci-fi comedy. I guess that's a pretty good description of it. But it feels like they just had a hard time kind of zeroing in on the tone.
Yeah,
of the film.
I would agree with that completely.
Yeah, and I didn't have, like I said at the beginning when I was first kind of giving you my reception, overall reception to the movie, I just found myself while I was watching it and even saying to myself, yeah, this isn't that bad at all most of the time. I just never cared about what was going to happen. Whereas, you know, I think back to really any other movie that we've covered before this, you know, They Live or The Thing, Prince of Darkness, even, where I at least care about how it's going to end. This movie, I did not care how it was going to end at all. And then when it did, I was like, oh my God, really? He's just skiing down those slopes.
Invisible skier.
I don't know. I felt it also, I thought the ending was also pretty abrupt.
It was.
We're clocking in at an hour and 39 minutes, which is fine. I'm glad this movie wasn't any longer than that. But again, as far as just the pacing, I felt the end was extremely abrupt. And it was just like, oh, okay, that's the end. The credits are already rolling over this as he's skiing down the slopes. Sorry for any spoilers, but I can't imagine anyone would have listened to the show this long if they had never seen it.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that. I think there are just, the character beats don't hit hard enough. I don't think Nick and Alice are that interesting as characters, and you might have been able to get away with that in a more sort of action-oriented movie, but like, if there is a genre for this, I would say action blockbuster, right? Like, it is, I mentioned things like Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade and Terminator 2 and Tim Burton's Batman. I mean, it feels like it's of a piece with those movies in some sense, but it lacks the personality of those movies. So, you know, if you think back toward those films, they're very character-driven films. I mean, they've got the amazing action sequences and chase sequences and everything, but like Jack Nicholson as the Joker and the relationship between Edward Furlong and Arnold Schwarzenegger, and even just sort of Indiana Jones and his dad kind of bantering back and forth in Last Crusade. Like, those are the things that really stick with us from those movies. Like, the other stuff can't work if the character stuff doesn't work. And, you know, I think just because there were such wildly different ideas of what this was going to be, they neglected to really include that. And, you know, once we sort of see what this movie is and we get that great scene in the beginning with the building and we see how great these special effects are going to be, like, it kind of empties its bag of tricks very quickly. And although there's interesting ideas along the way and there's good gags occasionally and we do see some great special effects later on, like, I love when she puts makeup on his face to sort of make him almost sort of look visible again, and then he's eating at a restaurant and he wipes his mouth and like wipes part of his face off. I thought that was kind of great. But yeah. like they're just little gags, right? Like that scene just kind of ends and she's like, all right, well, I guess we can't be out in public now. So they just don't stay out in public. I mean, you know, it's like the scenes don't build in a way that is really sort of engaging, and the character arcs don't really build in a way that's engaging. But I mean, I said at the beginning of this, I enjoyed this movie, and I did. I mean, part of it was just that feel, like it definitely had the feel of those types of movies like I was mentioning, and the story is not terrible. I mean, it's a fairly solid chase movie. I mean, I don't like that he has to sort of narrate in voiceover, this is why I talked to this person, and then I went to this place, and that kind of stuff doesn't work. But I mean, I think Sam Neill is a very compelling villain. He's really pretty evil and does a great villain monologue. Another one of my favorite scenes is just the moment where he's sitting by himself, or so he thinks, in his office. And
read my mind.
Yeah, and Nick is there just kind of cowering in the corner, and then they have this confrontation where Nick is invisible. Like, Jenkins realizes eventually that he's being watched, that Nick is there with him. So he starts talking to him almost in a way that, like, he thinks he's there, but he's not sure that he's there and he doesn't know where he is. I mean, I thought that was a clever moment. And then it leads to one of my favorite gags or devices in the film, where Nick holds a gun to Jenkins' head and it's just this sort of disembodied gun just kind of waving in the guy's face. I thought that was a cool little effect. Not as good as a similar thing that I don't want to spoil in the recent Invisible Man movie, which just really, really threw me for a loop. It was the best scene in that movie. But, you know, there's little stuff like that along the way that I think works really well. It just doesn't really come together as a whole and never kind of reconciles all the things that it wants to do.
Yep, that's all very true. And I mean, unfortunately...
Can I just mention one thing? Correction, yeah. A little asterisk mm-hmm. here. I said Lon Chaney before. It was Claude Rains in the original Invisible Man. So I just want to mention that.
Very well. something else I wanted to mention about this that I was reading, you know, this movie sounds like it was a very difficult shoot and took a long time to make. I read something about how they basically had to shoot a lot of things twice in order to implement a lot of the effects. And apparently, you know, Carpenter is quoted by saying that Chevy Chase and Hannah were the stuff of nightmares and impossible to direct. I can only imagine what some of the days on the set were like. And unfortunately, we talked about this a little bit at the beginning, but I mean, when it comes down to the bottom line, I mean, yeah, this movie really didn't do anything for John Carpenter's career, especially after coming off this period of stagnation where, you know, this is like, in a lot of ways, I mean, this is his return as a director, especially coming from a guy who is cranking out basically a movie or two every year. This movie lost a lot of money at the box office. I think the estimated numbers on it are the budget at about $35 million. And it made, what, $14.5 million? And it was also received very negatively by critics. So, unfortunately, you know, say what you want about the movie, but as far as the way it was received and from a monetary point of view, this really couldn't have been a good thing for John Carpenter's career.
No, I don't think anybody was happy with the eventual result here, right? I mean, Carpenter had a tough time on set. And Chevy Chase, as we've talked about on the show before, he's just sort of known as this very arrogant personality that is not easy to direct, not easy to get along with. I read something about how, you know, I don't think he realized going into this how much special effects work that he was going to be directly involved in by having to wear the suits and the makeup and everything. And I think he was just kind of frustrated with that and didn't want to do it. So he'd just like take the makeup off and kind of ruin the day of shooting for everybody else. Daryl Hannah, I read the same thing where she was not easy to get along with either. Although, interestingly enough, I read something else that there was a great article that just came out about this movie to basically coincide with the Invisible Man, the Lee Whannell Invisible Man that came out earlier this year. And they were kind of looking back on this sort of Invisible Man reboot. And basically what it said was Daryl Hannah and Chevy Chase got along great. They really hit it off on set and remained friends. They remained close after this. And everybody else just sort of hated each other, except for John Carpenter and Sam Neill, of course, who would go on to be in The Mouth of Madness.
Yes.
But I don't know. It just seems like this was like a lot of big ideas and a lot of ambition, and then the production of it just kind of didn't go well, and everything from that point on was just kind of a catastrophe. Chris, I have to imagine that there were tons of articles written in the wake of the box office failure of this movie where some very, very clever writer was just like, audiences didn't see The Invisible Man or something like that. And then they filed the copy and patted themselves on the back. I mean, it's the kind of movie that kind of became probably a laughing stock. And, you know, even you and I, when we've been talking about Carpenter's filmography, and I remembered so little about this movie, and you didn't really know it that well either, we're just expecting this to be this colossal failure of a bad movie and something we could make fun of. But, you know, I sort of feel for everybody involved. I mean, I don't think even Chevy Chase, who probably I wouldn't get along with, but I am a fan of his, and I think he's a very talented guy, and I would have loved to have seen the best version of this movie, you know, like if he had been able to realize his ambition and Carpenter had been able to sort of make this the tour de force of direction that we know that he's capable of. I mean, I texted you when I was watching this, the first, I think it was actually, I had finished it, you were watching it, and I said, I could see how this movie could be amazing. There are just changes that it needs that it seems like no one was able to make.
Yeah, and you know, I will say I'm excited to just make the proclamation that John Carpenter has still yet to make a bad movie on the journey that we've been on. This was the one that the whole time I was thinking, all right, we're going into the 90s, Memoirs of an Invisible Man. This is going to be the first like stinker, you know. And watching it this time, I was like, you know what? This movie's not bad. It's not a bad movie. So while it might be personally my least favorite, I still would not call it a bad movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely one of my least favorite, but I think it is more successful in some ways than, you know, I mentioned, you asked me, right? Like, is this your least favorite, or what is your least favorite Carpenter movie till this point? In some ways, Christine, because... not that that's a bad movie either. Like, I agree with you. I don't think he's made a bad movie to this point. But I think Christine could be so much more than what it was. And Prince of Darkness, I love the concept of that. I love the first half of that movie. Then it kind of like loses the thread a little bit about halfway through. And this one felt just a little bit more complete to me, which is crazy to say because we were just talking about how incomplete it kind of was. But I don't know. I mean, in some ways, this is more satisfying to me than those two movies were. I mean, this just feels like, you know, it's a Hollywood product that has all the things that a Hollywood product needs to have. And there's a part of me, because I grew up on Hollywood product, that kind of likes that. And certainly this is not up there with like the Terminator 2s of that era. But, you know, it's got a beginning, a middle, and an end. It's got some interesting, clever set pieces and sight gags. And it's got some good action scenes. By the way, I forgot to mention one of my favorite things that this movie, you know, just a thing that I don't think I've ever seen before, is when the bad guys are chasing Nick and they're using like spray paint guns to try to like find him and tag him and isolate him. I thought that was great. You know, there's fun little ideas like that that I don't think that ever gets used, right? Like, doesn't he never get sprayed with that spray paint gun? Maybe they couldn't afford that effect.
He doesn't, but his apartment does. His entire apartment does, and that made me cringe, man. I was just like,
oh, yeah, it's a nice apartment. Yeah. I guess that's another Carpenter thing, right? Nice apartments. We see those in a lot of his movies.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. I mean, I even when they're chasing him, I like those little dart guns that they have too. Those are pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, I like when they're using the dart guns, but like later they just use real guns. Like Jenkins kind of goes unhinged, rogue, off the rails, and then he becomes even more evil, which is good for the movie. But yeah, I don't know. I didn't like the idea of a lot of innocent characters get beat up and shot with tranquilizer guns and kind of harassed in this movie.
Yes, they do. Now, I'm just trying to think where I feel like I'm missing a major part of this movie, right towards the end, because he mentions something about, like, I don't know. It's earlier on in the movie. There's a scene where Nick and Alice are talking about what they like and what they don't like. You know, the conversations that you have when you're first getting involved in a relationship with somebody, which actually I thought was pretty funny, the back and forth dialogue they had there.
I like that scene. It's very Howard Hawksy. It's very it feels like that kind of romance that Carpenter, we know, is a fan of.
At one point Chevy Chase says, "I hate weightlifters," or something like
yes.
that. I don't know. I thought that's really funny. But yeah, he mentions that he loves skiing, and then That's the only time he mentions it, and at the end of the movie, he's skiing down the slopes there. I don't know, and I, you know, could you really have a relationship with an invisible person? You know, that was the other thing that I just kind of wasn't buying, how she's just like, I'm cool with it, you know? I don't know.
Well, it's an interesting idea to me that, like, at some point, and it's kind of nebulous, we never really get a great sense of it, but at some point during this film, Nick basically realizes that he's never going to get better, that there's no cure for his invisibility, it's not right. going away. Like, in the beginning of the film, you think the sort of thrust of the movie is like, all right, he needs to find the person that can make him visible again and take away this condition. I mean, it's almost presented like a disease that he has to live with, or a disability. Which it's kind of, you know, it's a blessing and a curse, right? It's a superpower, and it's also a huge problem in his life. And so a lot of these films, that is what the story is you get these powers, but it's like you want to go back to your normal life, and how do you do that? And at some point, it just seems sort of, it's never really explicitly said, but it's kind of established that, nope, he's going to be invisible forever. So anyone who wants to be with him in a relationship is probably going to be invisible too. And he gets her pregnant at one point there, and it's implied at the end of the film that she's going to have his baby. And so I guess the question is, are they going to have like a half invisible baby? Which I would totally watch the half invisible baby movie. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of an interesting way to end the film in that he's still invisible. So they do have to sort of go off and build a life together, and they go to Switzerland or whatever, and seems to be enjoying himself, and she does too. But the idea that he's going to probably grow old and die as an invisible man, I mean, maybe there's an interesting movie there, and maybe that's the one where Chevy Chase could really explore the sort of pathos and drama of what it's like to be invisible. But I don't know. I mean, he seems to do just about everything. They seem to have a pretty rockin' sex life for a couple where one of them is not even able to be seen.
This is something I thought of as well. So another thing
is this not about invisible sex? I thought we were going to talk about invisible sex.
Another thing that we should point out is, again, as we've talked about on the show, you know, Carpenter scores the majority of his movies, and I did briefly mention Shirley Walker before. Obviously, he's used other composers, most famously Ennio Morricone in The Thing, and I can never pronounce his last name. Is it Jack Nitzsche?
Nietzsche?
Right, did the wonderful score for Starman.
Yes, love that one.
But Shirley Walker, I thought the movie, the music in this movie was pretty good and pretty effective, and I can't wait till we get to Escape from LA, because they did some really cool stuff with that score, not only with just brand new material, but she collaborated with John Carpenter on that movie, and they kind of like modernize the main theme from Escape from New York. And I enjoy what they did with it very much. So Shirley Walker will again work with John Carpenter in the near future.
Yeah, not a total loss in that respect, right? Because right. he does end up with the star for In the Mouth of Madness, as we were saying. I mean, like, Carpenter is that guy who does like to have that those people he can trust and continue collaborating with. And Chevy Chase, I guess, was never going to be one of those. But Shirley Walker and Sam Neill, I guess they did build a good working relationship here.
Yeah, indeed. Now, Nick, I'm not exactly sure what's on our itinerary next here, because if we go movie-wise, we should probably discuss off-air what we're going to do, because I do want to get in another musical episode and cover the second volume of Lost Themes sooner than later. I think that's something that definitely warrants a discussion. And then film-wise after this, we're going into an anthology movie called Body Bags. 1993's Body Bags.
Yeah, I think we should do Body Bags next, because I'm really looking forward to talking about that one. And then the next two are kind of back-to-back to 1995 releases. After that, we get In the Mouth of Madness and Village of the Damned. So I think
Correct.
Maybe we'll nail down Body Bags, then we'll do Lost Themes, and then we'll continue with the chronological tour of Carpenter's filmography with the mid-90s now.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting one. And you know what? This gives me faith, though, Nick. This memoirs experiment that we did here, this gives me faith that I think some of the movies coming up that you may remember as being misfires or, you know, not that solid of pictures, I think, I don't know, I'm optimistic that I think you're going to like some of the ones, because I know you haven't seen... Or have you seen Body Bags?
I have not seen Body Bags. Aha. I have not seen Village of the Damned. Escape from L.A. I saw when it came out, so that was 20-plus years ago.
That doesn't count. That doesn't count.
All right.
Okay. Oh, have you seen Vampires?
I saw that when it came out, too. So, again, 20-plus wow. years ago. And
it's going to be all pretty It's gonna be all pretty fresh for you. Yeah. These next ones coming out. Okay, good.
Well, I
Excellent.
Mean, just this movie alone was fascinating because I distinctly remember watching this movie as a kid, but, like, I remembered so little about it. And I don't know. I mean, I can see why I liked it back then, and I kind of still like it now.
Excellent. I love it. Love it.
All right. So with that in mind and with that all behind us, I mean, Chris, any final thoughts on memoirs? I think we covered it pretty well.
I believe we covered it pretty well, too. I will say I do not own this on Blu-ray. It is the only John Carpenter movie. Or wait, is that right? No, that's not true. I don't have the Vampires Blu-ray, which Shout Factory just released like less than a year ago. Just for the sole purposes of having the collection, I may actually get this one, but it is the only one that I currently do not have on Blu-ray. But it is available on Blu-ray for you folks out there that are interested. Shout Factory is apparently obsessed with John Carpenter, and they have been releasing like everything.
Even this.
On.
Oh, well, Chris, let me ask you this question, because you are a guy who watches movies multiple times, even if they're not your favorite movies. I'm a guy who, you know, I'm generally more interested in seeing new things. I don't buy a lot of movies anymore. And if I'm going to sit down for 2 hours and watch a film, you know, if it's not for this show, it'll usually be something that I haven't seen before. But I feel like I could put this movie on and enjoy it again. I'm not going to say it's not going to be a yearly or multi-yearly viewing experience like Halloween is for me or The Thing.
Mm-hmm.
But
yes.
I could definitely see myself putting this on some afternoon, maybe when I'm hungover like Nick Holloway someday, and just kind of relaxing with it and enjoying it for what it is. Do you think you would watch this movie multiple times?
I don't know. I'm going to go with, I think it would be a good hangover movie. So like, yeah, absolutely would watch this hungover. But I'm not really looking forward to seeing it anytime soon again. I think maybe like a couple years from now, I would be willing to revisit it again. But I would rather watch any other Carpenter movie over this. So.
Okay, fair enough. There are things about this that I'd be interested in seeing again. And like I said, I enjoy Chevy Chase. I mean, Caddyshack is the one of his I watch every year, and Christmas Vacation, as you were saying also. But
yeah, don't forget Funny Farm. I love that movie.
Oh, Funny Farm is great too, yeah. That was not too, it was like 87, 88. Anyway, we'll get back to our Chevy Chase discussion next week on Precinct 13, the movies of Chevy Chase. But if you would like to talk about John Carpenter with us, we'd love for you to drop us an email or send us a message or get in touch with us however you feel like getting in touch with us. Let us know how we're doing and what you would like to hear in the weeks ahead and how you feel about Memoirs of an Invisible Man. And if we did it justice, our email is precinct13podcast@gmail.com. We're on Twitter at 13precinct, facebook.com/13precinct, and our website where you can download all our episodes, find all our subscription links, is precinct13.simplecast.com. We would really appreciate a rating and a review. Give us some feedback there, and we will do our best to honor it, and we really appreciate it anyway. And yeah, we'll be back to take on John Carpenter's, I think, first anthology film, not his last participation in anthology projects. I cannot wait to talk about Cigarette Burns, but until then, we've got Body Bags to deal with.
I cannot wait.
Mark Hamill's in that movie, right?
The third part of there's three short movies. The first two are directed by John Carpenter. The last is actually directed by the late, great Toby Hooper.
Oh.
And yes, stars Mark Hamill.
I don't think I even knew that. I thought Carpenter did all three of them. So
Hooper did the third.
We'll get a little Hooper talk. Yeah, rest in peace, Toby Hooper. Definitely gone before his time. Another horror visionary right up there with Carpenter, I think, in a lot of ways. All right.
I'm one of the few that love The Mangler.
The Mangler's not bad. We talked about that on our previous show. That would be fun.
Sorry, I had to throw that in there.
Well, go watch The Mangler and definitely watch Body Bags, and we'll be back in 2 weeks to talk about it.